On va commencer. Bienvenue à cette dernière après-midi de colloque. Welcome to the last, first session of the last half day of our conference on crime and justice. It's my, before my great pleasure, I'll ask you to please turn your cell phones or smartphones to silent, to tweet away, as many of you have been doing. Been very interesting to follow. To remind you that there's a vestiaire, a cloakroom, if you wish to leave your coats there, and so on. I'm going to introduce the moderators of both today's sessions at once. The first session, which will begin momentarily, is going to be moderated by Professor Alana Klein. She teaches in the Faculty of Law at McGill. She teaches and researches in the areas of constitutional law, human rights law, international law, and criminal law. Prior to joining the faculty, she was a senior policy analyst with the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network, where she worked on HIV/AIDS and immigration. She's taught at Columbia Law School and Columbia University and has interned with the International Refugee Program at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights and the Palestinian Ministry of Economy and Trade. In 2002 and 2003, she was a law clerk to former Supreme Court of Canada Justice Louise Arbour, and she was appointed to the Human Rights Commission in 2006. Following that, the second session of the afternoon is going to be chaired, a slight rearrangement for the second session. Edward Greenspan could not make it because of a trial and a conflict, Judge Healy, who was going to be on the panel, is going to switch places with Harvey Yourofsky, who is going to chair it, so that we have a criminal lawyer on the panel, and we have a judge moderating the panel, which is sort of the perfect moderator, I guess, you could wish for. Judge Patrick Healy, in 2007, was appointed as judge to the Court of Quebec Criminal and Penal Division in Montreal. He is a former editor-in-chief of the McGill Law Journal during his student days. He joined the Faculty of Law's professoriate in 1990. Judge Healy has taught in many areas, but his greatest vocation was criminal law, both in its teaching and study. And his research in the area of sentencing is highly regarded by colleagues across the country, and indeed has contributed to the emergence of sentencing as the object of a field of academic inquiry across Canada. His involvement in learned societies and professional associations devoted to criminal law heightened McGill's profile in this area. So without further ado, I will turn this over to Professor Alana Klein, who will introduce the panelists and moderate the session.
Thank you very much, Will. Welcome back, everyone. Normally, I always, at this stage, wish that everyone had a good post-lunch coffee, but actually, you look like quite a lively crowd, so that's great. I'd also like to begin by thanking Marlene Jennings, Danielle Jutras, and most of all, Will Straw for making this event happen and for allowing me to be a part of it. A number of speakers at this conference have remarked that this conference is timely. Bill C-10, which we can all say without exaggeration is landscape-changing, became law in our country 2 days ago. The bill will have impacts, direct and indirect, on innumerable aspects of criminal justice and our society, and we've talked about those at length during the course of this conference. But surely the greatest immediate impact will be on sentencing and imprisonment. And for that reason, our panel today is really at the core, our panel right now is really at the core of what makes this conference timely. We're lucky to have with us three speakers, all of whom share a long view, a deep view, and a close view of corrections practices in Canada. All three appeared before parliamentary committees on Bill C-10, and from each of their own experiences and perspectives, criticized the bill for taking Canada in the wrong direction in a number of ways, and we're going to hear a little bit about that today. I'll begin by introducing the first panelist, and then after that I'll introduce the next so that we don't have 15 minutes of introductions only before we get to the substance. Our first speaker is Howard Sapers. He's already been lauded today as a little-known hero, though truth be told, his heroism is known and appreciated by many. He is the Correctional Investigator for Canada, also known as the Federal Prisons Ombudsman. This means that it's his job to listen to the experiences of federal prison inmates and to investigate and report to Parliament about how to improve corrections in Canada. Before serving in this role, he was a member of the Legislative Assembly of Alberta. Indeed, he had a long and rich political career in provincial politics in Alberta, and he was, among other things, there the official opposition House leader. Howard, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Alana. And let me start by just correcting one thing. As a as a public servant in this role, I don't appear before parliamentary committees to criticize the government. I take the approach that Will Rogers took when he said that he doesn't tell jokes, he just observes the government and reports the facts. So I am neutral, and I just wanted to put that on the record. It really is quite an honor to be here, and I want to add to the thanks to Marlene and to the other organizers. There you are. Well, there's a poll where Will should be. It is really something to be part of this panel in particular, and to be part of the program. And today's discussion so far have been terrific. I hope I can add to them just a little bit. And I'll start by reflecting on something that Betsy Powell said when she opened the panel on the press and criminal justice, and she talked about 80%. You know, she's sort of, her job satisfaction was down. Well, I got to say, in corrections, if you're having an 80% day, it's a pretty good day. And I don't mean to be cynical, but I'd settle for 80% most days. Today, I want to talk about the purpose and the principles of incarceration a little bit. And I also want to describe who it is that populate our prisons and jails, and just raise a couple of questions about who it is that we incarcerate, for what purpose, for how long, and why. And to set the stage a little bit for that, there's been a lot of discussion so far over the last couple of days about, you know, soft on crime, tough on crime. I have no idea what soft on crime means. I've been in the system for a long time, and I've never experienced soft on crime. I actually have never met anybody that likes people to get away with murder, get off scot-free. I've never talked to anybody that doesn't think there should be consequences for antisocial behavior. I'm just perplexed now when I see that the debate about something so fundamentally important be reduced to these bumper stickers, and I'm puzzled by that. You know, the criminal justice system in Canada, I guess it's obvious to say, it's not about private harm and exacting revenge, right? It's about public safety, public order, and the public good. We don't leave it to individuals to pursue private justice. That's not how our system works. So victims in our system don't play the role sometimes that some think that they should, but we have to remember that the criminal courts really aren't set up to respond to the various needs that victims have. That's not to say that their loss shouldn't be acknowledged, that harm doesn't need to be addressed, that victims need to be given voice, they need to be given support to heal. But it's just that it's beyond the mandate and the ability of the system as it's designed, particularly of the courts and of sentencing, to do that. I don't think that we can serve victims best by heaping unrelenting punishment upon offenders. I'm not sure how we got to that equation. You know, the role of courts is to determine guilt and impose consequences. The sentencing judge is to consider the law, mitigating circumstances, aggravating circumstances, take the gravity of the offense into account. The punishment is supposed to be proportionate in some measure. Sentencing decisions must be highly individualized. You know, no two offenses are exactly the same. No two fact patterns are exactly the same. No two offenders are exactly the same. And, of course, the crime doesn't land on any two victims in exactly the same way either. So it's supposed to be an individualized process. And in the same way, post-sentencing, you know, when we talk about parole, parole hearings aren't really about victims. Parole hearings are about assessing an offender's readiness to be released. It's about risk. It's about risk of future harm. Parole hearings aren't about past harm. And so again, while victims' voice is important, perhaps that's not the best place for their voice to be heard. Indeed, once a court passes sentence, questions about seriousness, proportionality, responsibility all begin to fade into the background. The courts have already taken these factors into account, and they've pronounced a judgment. Correctional authorities need to be mindful, of course, of a court's decisions and reasons. But in corrections, their job is administrative, not judicial. The sentence is to be carried out without adding to the punishment that was imposed by the courts. It's not the responsibility of those who run prisons to determine if punishment has been sufficient. There's an old adage in corrections that, you know, you're sent to prison as your punishment, not for your punishment. Correctional practice is governed by a legal framework that empowers the state to only interfere with the life and liberty of incarcerated to the minimum extent necessary. Inmates, of course, retain all rights except for those that are muted by the sentence itself. The rule of law follows an offender into a penitentiary. Legality doesn't stop at the prison gate. Now, I make these comments really just to build the foundation for understanding my concerns about who it is that's ending up inside Canada's penitentiaries. The face of corrections in Canada is changing. Offenders are getting older, they're more addicted, they're more diverse, and they're more mentally disordered. The average level of educational attainment upon admission is grade 8. Visible minorities, Aboriginal people, and women are entering correctional facilities in greater numbers than ever before. 1 in 5 federal inmates is now aged over 50. 36% are now identified at admission as requiring some kind of mental health follow-up or service. 1 in 5 is of Aboriginal descent, and 9% of inmates are Black Canadians. In the last 5 years, the number of federally incarcerated women has increased by almost 40%. Over the last decade, the number of Aboriginal women has grown a staggering 86%. The use of prison, therefore, is a barometer for measuring the success or failure of some key Canadian social policies. Clues to how we have chosen to respond to homelessness, poverty, addiction, education, mental illness, unemployment, and vocational participation and preparation can be found by studying prison populations. The point here is that prison reflects society. It's not separate from it. Just as Canadian society is growing older and more diverse, so too is the inmate population. This changing and complex profile is placing increasing pressures and strains on the correctional system to provide safe and secure accommodation and custody. Before Bill C-10, but between February of 2009 and today, the federally incarcerated population has increased by 1,100 inmates, or 8.2%. Now, that's the equivalent of about 2 large male medium security institutions. But we didn't build 2 more institutions. The Correctional Service of Canada has plans to build 2,700 new cells at over 30 existing penitentiaries at a total cost of about $600 million. Once built, it'll cost Canadians an average of about $110,000 per year to house a male offender in one of those cells, and nearly twice that to hold a maximum security woman inmate. Next year, CSC's total budget will exceed $3 billion for the first time ever. Close to 16% of the incarcerated population are now double bunked in cells which were designed for only one inmate, a phenomenon which has increased by more than 50% in the past 5 years alone, despite the fact that evidence in Canada and internationally shows that prisons, as they become more crowded, they become more desperate, more violent, and more volatile. Simply put, safety is compromised by prison crowding, and effective corrections suffers as a result. Questions about whom we incarcerate, for how long, and why are public policy issues of the highest order. They say much about who we are as a society and the values that we espouse. It's a paradox that incarceration rates are climbing at the same time that crime rates are falling. In spite of the peaceful nature of our society, more of our citizens than ever before are being sent to prisons. Aboriginal people are incarcerated in Canada at a rate that is 9 times higher than for the rest of us. In fact, if not for the steady increases in Aboriginal, female, mentally ill, and visible minority offenders, the offender population in Canada would have flatlined years ago. Over 25% of federal offenders are serving a life sentence. Most lifers will become elderly behind bars, many of them dying there. More offenders than ever are spending more time at higher security levels. The use of long-term segregation to manage the mentally ill continues, despite the fact that isolation, seclusion, and deprivation exacerbate their mental illness. There are few, if any, correctional programs being delivered in Canada's maximum security penitentiaries. More of an offender's sentence is being spent locked up with minimal movement and association. Many offenders who pose little risk to public safety are spending more of their sentence behind bars rather than under supervision in the community. Day and full parole grant rates are at historic lows. This is not the way corrections in Canada was designed to work. After all, we know that the public is best served by the gradual and timely reintegration of offenders. As I said earlier, the purpose of incarceration is to prepare offenders for their safe eventual release. The point of incarceration is not to create good inmates. After all, the overwhelming majority of inmates are one day released, and the hope is that we will all be better off for their carceral experience. Over 4 decades ago, the report of the Canadian Committee on Corrections, commonly referred to as the WMET Committee, issued a report that expressed in clear and eloquent language what corrections could be. We would do well to find direction and inspiration in these words from that report, and I quote, "Segregate the dangerous, deter and restrain the rationally motivated professional criminal, deal as constructively as possible with every offender as the circumstances of the case permit, release the harmless, imprison the casual offender not committed to a criminal career only when no other disposition is appropriate, and in every disposition, the possibility of rehabilitation should be taken into account," end quote. In the final analysis, the legitimacy of imprisonment relies upon it being used as sparingly as possible. It's hard to imagine a society achieving its full potential by increasingly caging more of its citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is one that I know we're all looking forward to hearing from. In today's opening address by our Federal Minister of Justice, Rob Nicholson, we heard the familiar justifications for Bill C-10. And by my count, the interests of the victims of crime were mentioned at least 14 times. Steve Sullivan is the Executive Director of Ottawa Victim Services. He's been a national advocate for victims of crime for almost 2 decades and also served as the Federal Ombudsman for Victims of Crime. I know this will be a most enlightening talk, and I'd like to hear about what we can expect this new legal framework to do for crime victims. Steve.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank Marlene Jennings and the organizers as well for inviting me. It's often when, in the past, when these kinds of conferences take place and panels like sentencing, victims were often not always part of that, or they're mentioned but not really part of the discussion and what their views are. So it's really, I think it's great that you've invited me here today, and I give a perspective on victims of crime. I should say that I really fought the temptation to scrap my notes and just respond to what the minister had to say, because if you haven't learned it, victims are the center of the world right now, at least in Ottawa. But I say I come with a perspective because the reality is, contrary to what the minister and the government would have us believe, victims are not a homogeneous group who all agree on the same thing because they suffered the same kind of harm. They're different people before the victimization, the experiences of the victimization are different, and their experiences after the victimization are quite different. It can often depend on the color of your skin, it can often depend on the support systems you have, on the resources you have in your community or you have in your family. Those impact your ability to respond to and deal with the impact of the victimization. It is not because you are a victim of crime, you are then tough on crime. It is not because you are a victim of crime that you believe every offender should always go to prison for as long as possible. Contrary to what we often hear in the media, there was an op-ed in the Toronto Sun, I think on Monday or Tuesday, called Take the Hug at a Thug. And the article criticized the NDP for some parliamentary machinations that delayed the vote on Bill C-10, and criticized them, in fact, for caring more about offenders, or not caring about victims at all, and caring about offenders, and believing in such concepts as restorative justice and that those concepts could actually work. I got to tell you, and I was late to the game, but having worked with victims of crime who have chosen restorative justice as a road that they wanted to explore, restorative justice does work for some offenders. And people can actually support victims of crime, but oppose some measures put forward by their governments. I should also say, before I get into my remarks, that sentencing is really not an option or an interest or a concern for the majority of victims of crime. And I'm going to talk a little bit about sexual assault today, because that's the one when the ministers talk about the unreported crimes, they always talk about sexual assault victims and how the reporting rates are so low. It's probably 1 in 10 of sexual assault victims who actually report the crime to police. So I'll focus a little bit on them. So for 9 out of 10 sexual assault victims, sentencing means nothing, because they have, for whatever reason, chosen not to report the crime to police. Right, so if you're not going to report to police, sentencing is not an option. And contrary to what some would have us believe, the failure of the justice system to take sexual assault seriously is not the reason the majority of most sexual assault victims don't report. Most do because they don't want anyone to know what happened, because we have yet as a society to fully, understand and convey the message to sexual assault survivors that they weren't to blame for what happened. We still do that in our own families. We do that in the press. We do that in movies. We do that everywhere. So most sexual assault survivors don't report because they don't want anyone to know, because they feel responsible and they don't think people are going to believe them, or they feel that they're going to be blamed. And sadly enough, they're probably right about a lot of those things. Of those sexual assault survivors who do choose to report to police, there's a higher unfounded rate of sexual assault reporting than other types of crimes. So unfounded means the police have decided this crime didn't happen or wasn't attempted. Right? The unfounded rates for sexual assault are much higher than other crimes. So the likelihood of police actually laying a charge in sexual assault cases is much lower than other types of crime. And the acquittal rate for sexual assault is much higher than other violent crime as well. But if you are a sexual assault survivor, has chosen to report the crime, and if the police actually lay a charge in your case, and if the Crown Prosecutor actually chooses to prosecute that case, and if you actually see a conviction at the end of the day, then sentencing does become an option for you. It becomes an interest for you. And it takes on, sadly, much more of a meaning and significance than really I think it should for many victims of crime. That process I talked about, reporting, investigation, charging, for many cases can take years. We are supporting right now a young woman who was assaulted in a different province, and we have recently supported her going through a preliminary inquiry. She was allowed to testify via closed circuit television from Ottawa to that province. It's been 4 years since she reported the sexual assault, and she reported the night after, the minutes, half an hour after it happened. 4 years, and they've just gone through the preliminary inquiry. The trial is likely to start early next year. She actually, at the preliminary hearing, told us that she was of two minds. One, that she wanted this to go forward because she wanted this person to be held accountable for the harm he had caused. But also, she really wouldn't have minded if the judge had said there's not enough evidence, because then it would be over. So she's got to wait another year to go through this, through the trial. The sentencing matters because, for many victims, because of the crime and the harm that they suffered, but for some, equally as much because of what we put them through in the process. Right? I've talked to families who've said to me, mothers of children who've been sexually abused, who said, I put my kids through all of this for that? That's the sentence? That's what we did all of this for? And that's a problem because victim advocacy groups, and I count myself in that, police, media, the community, Crowns, we all tell victims in one way or another that the sentence is the measure of the harm against them. Right? That at the end of the day, how serious we took the harm committed against you is that magic number of how many years that person's going to spend in prison or on probation or in the community under supervision. And that's a falsehood. We have set victims up to be disappointed by sentencing. Sentencing, as I think as Howard has talked about, the criminal justice system was never set up, it was never arranged to consider and respond to the needs of victims of crime. Now, I think it can do a better job at doing those things, but that's not, it will never be the core goal of the criminal justice system, nor should it. But sentencing is, it's not even if we want it to be, it can never respond to the harm that people have suffered. Sheldon Kennedy, who many of you may know, was a former NHL star, who suffered, along with other young hockey players, horrific sexual abuse by their coach. I don't know if you've ever read Sheldon's book. He's probably one of the nicest guys you will ever meet. He tells a story in his book. He comes from a small town in the prairies where they would, if his family went to the McDonald's in the city, they would bring the wrappers back for show and tell. He's just kind of like an aw shucks kind of guy. Genuine, wonderful guy. He testified recently on Bill C-10. And in Sheldon's case, the offender, I think, got about 3 years. And in Sheldon's mind, and certainly I think justifiably and understandably so, that wasn't enough for the number of sexual acts that he had suffered at that individual's hands. The mandatory minimum provisions of the bill that Sheldon was talking about were actually less than 3 years. Right? So Sheldon was testifying in support of a bill that, from his own perspective, was setting down sentencing options that he didn't think were strong enough. That's the problem we have, right? In a year or 2 years, when the Bill C-10 sexual offenses provisions take place, there will be a family, there will be parents, understandably, who say, look, this 1.5 year mandatory minimum you have for this, that's not enough. And so what's the response of the government? Well, we have to make it tougher. Well, is 3 years enough for the sexual abuse of a child? I don't know. Is 5 years enough? Is 7 years enough? The sentencing will never, ever be the measure of harm committed against that child or that woman or that man. And I think that's a message that we, victim advocacy groups, the community and reporters and those in the justice system, have to give to victims that, look, the sentence is based on a number of different things. Your harm is one of them, but it's not the guiding factor. But the way we do it now is that we set victims up to equate justice with the sentence. We set them up to seek justice in the sentence. If you're a sexual assault victim, the maximum penalty is 10 years. The minimum sentence could be probation. Understand from a victim's perspective who really doesn't know much about the justice system that you've gone through all this for a couple years, you've put your life on hold while this process has played out, and the maximum's 10 years and your guy gets a year. How do you get to that from point A to point B from that victim's perspective? It's understandably going to be a disappointment, and we have set victims up in that way. We're told that Bill C-10 will solve all that, right? That victims are going to be happy now, that their problems are going to be solved. I think that's challenging to believe for those of us who work on the front line with victims of crime, regardless of what that crime is. The Parliamentary Budget Officer did a report just on the changes to conditional sentencing of Bill C-10. And for those who don't know, conditional sentences known as house arrest is no longer eligible for many serious offenses, including sexual assault. The Parliamentary Budget Officer suggests that we're actually going to, because people now aren't going to plead guilty because they're going to get conditional sentences, so they're going to want more trials. Right? There's no incentive to plead guilty, so why wouldn't I go for a trial? From our perspective, that means more victims will have to testify. That's not a fun thing when you're a sexual assault victim in a courtroom. Trust me, it's as far as we've come, and we like to think we've come in trying to make the courtroom more friendly or less aggressive towards sexual assault victims, we haven't really come that far. He also estimates there'll be fewer convictions, right? Fewer guys are going to plead guilty, so we're going to have more trials, and that means more people will be acquitted. Those are people who would have pled guilty before. So from a victim perspective, more trials, fewer convictions. The supervision's actually going to be shorter. That under the house arrest models, you'd actually have a guy who's under supervision longer than these people will be in custody now. And it's all going to cost a lot more money. He estimated, I think, around $38,000 difference between guys who are on conditional sentences and guys who will be in prison. $35,000 per inmate. I know quite well, and one of the people who testified before the parliamentary committee was a woman named Wilma Dirksen. Wilma's daughter was murdered about 25 years ago. Wilma's not one of those victims that the minister talked about. She testified against the bill. And she was on a radio show the next day, and they asked her, well, you know, when Wilma went to her support group and said, well, what should I tell them when I go testify? What, you know, they're going to ask me these questions. What should I tell them we should actually spend the money on? And she thought it would be more prisons and tougher penalties. And actually, the group came back and said education. Right? So she was asked by the reporter, well, what would you do with all the money? And not seriously, but one of the things she said, you know, if we're going to throw the money away, what would have been nice is if somebody had said to some of these families that I work with who have young children or who have siblings who just lost their loved ones or people who just lost their parents, here's $35,000. Go get counseling. Go on a vacation. Go do something for yourself. Now, she wasn't serious about actually taking the money and giving it to individual victims. But it is, if we're going to throw it away, wouldn't it be better to spend it on that sexual assault victim who might not be able to return to her work because of the trauma she's going through, who might need some counseling, who might need some time off? If the government's throwing money away like it doesn't matter and victims of crime are a priority, it's interesting that nothing in this bill will actually help alleviate the financial burdens on victims of crime. What the research tells us, in fact, about victims is the process is more important than the outcome. That if we do the process right, if we keep victims informed, if we consult them, if we ask their opinions, we don't give them decision-making powers, but Crowns ask their opinions and they consult and actually consider what it is victims have to say. Some of the most high-profile cases that I've been involved with, when Crowns would sit down with families and say, you know, we can go for the highest charge, but we have concerns about our evidence, so we might lose. Here's what we're considering. More times than not, victims will actually agree with the Crown Prosecutor. So if we do the outcome well, then if we do the process well, the outcome becomes less important. So the sentence actually becomes less of the symbol of their harm because they've been treated well through the whole process. Sadly, all the victims of crime legislation we have and victims' bills of rights and our statement of principles, we don't do the process very well. Most victims, if they're lucky, might get to see the Crown before the trial. Police officers are busy. Sexual assault victims receive very different treatment from police and others in the system than other victims of crime. We don't do the process very well. So the outcome becomes the most important part of this exercise for them. And I'll tell you, having worked a little bit in the corrections end of things with victims of crime, I don't know how many parole hearings I've been with families of murder victims or sexual assault survivors, but in the end of the outcome, whether the individual gets parole or doesn't, they may not always agree with that decision. But when they sit in that parole room and they hear the questions from the parole board members, which contrary to public opinion are not easy questions to have to answer, and the offender has to explain what he did, why he did it, what he's been doing in prison, why he hasn't done this, how the programs are working or not working. The victims begin to understand the decision. Right? We're going to give him parole because, or we're not going to give him parole because. So they may not like the end result, but they understand it. And I'll tell you, I've walked in with families who were terrified of the possibility of this offender being released and walking out saying, you know what, I think the SOB should have stayed in a bit longer, but I'm not scared anymore. That's the process, and it can work. But we don't do that very well in our criminal justice system. So the outcome becomes the major goal. And it is a false hope. It is a false promise for most victims of crime who choose to seek justice in our justice system. That's not a very nice thing to say, that most victims who seek justice from our justice system actually are disappointed. But it's a reality. One of the things we know from victim impact statements, and I'll finish with this, one of the things we know that actually affects the victim's satisfaction with having done an impact statement, which they can't speak to sentence, they're not a party to the proceedings, but they can talk about the impact of the crime on them. One of the things that impacts their satisfaction the most is whether the judge in his or her sentencing remarks acknowledges the harm that they've suffered. Not that the sentence was tougher because of the harm, that he or she has acknowledged the harm that they've suffered. That's really what most crime victims want, right? They want accountability. They want their harm to be validated. They want their harm to be acknowledged. And they want to be treated with respect and that they are a part of this process. They don't control the process, but that their interests are as important as everybody else's, and they deserve to have a voice in that process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Finally, our last speaker for this panel is Michael Jackson, who's a law professor at the University of British Columbia and a human rights advocate, activist, and scholar. He's a groundbreaker in so many ways. I'm sure many of you know his work. He wrote the very first book on prison justice in Canada, Justice Behind Walls, in 1974, and has continued to publish the seminal books on corrections and imprisonment in Canada since then. He's successfully argued some of the most important cases before the Supreme Court of Canada, including cases on prisoners' rights and also key Aboriginal cases that will be known at the very least to many of the law students in the room, Delgamuukw and Haida Nation. We're very lucky to have him with us today, and I look forward to hearing from him, Professor Michael Jackson.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the organizers for inviting me. I'm going to talk about the future of the criminal justice system at the deep end in the federal penitentiary system, a system which will in fact be much more relied upon as a result of Bill C-10 in the future. And I don't profess to be a prophet, but I have seen the future. Let me explain that. I began work in the prisons a long, long time ago, in the early 1970s, and my first foray into a courtroom in Canada was in a case in which I challenged the conditions of solitary confinement in what was called the penthouse of the BC Penitentiary. We had club feds in those days as well. This penthouse was unlike any penthouse any of you have been in. Men were caged in concrete vaults 23 and a half hours a day. They were not permitted outside exercise. They were strip searched every time they came out of their cells. They were under the supervision of armed guards. It was a horrendous experience. I interviewed, as part of that court case, two men, one who had been driven mad and couldn't instruct me, the other man who, the week after I interviewed him, was literally driven to death. He hanged himself. When Senator Boisvenu, a few weeks ago, referred to giving murderers, this man wasn't a murderer, a rope as part of their induction package into a penitentiary, I found that deeply offensive. Deeply offensive, and I can tell you every prisoner in Canada was shocked to find a government representative espouse the view that the penance of punishment should be at the end of a rope. I've represented, there are others in the room like Kim Pate, who've represented offenders, particularly Aboriginal women, who've ended their sentences at the end of a rope. In the 1970s, I also experienced the impact of a system of imprisonment which was characterized by inhumanity and injustice. I was in the BC Penitentiary negotiating the release of hostages in 1976, and I saw the explosive power of 500 men who were brutalized by the experience. They destroyed a 100-year-old prison. They broke through the interior walls. I don't know how they did it. They didn't have weapons. They had the power of rage, and it's an explosive, dangerous power. Now, it was after those riots in 1976-77 that a parliamentary committee was formed, an all party, non-partisan, strange words, aren't they? Non-partisan committee went to every maximum security penitentiary in the country and wrote a report. It's a really powerful report, and I'm going to just read to you a... No, I won't read to you. I'll remember it. They said there's a great deal of irony in the fact that imprisonment epitomizes injustice. The product of the justice system epitomizes injustice. And they recommended to guard against and address and redress the inhumanity of Canadian prisons in the 1970s after a series of riots and hostage takings and violent incidents unprecedented in Canadian history, that two principles had to be introduced. One, that the rule of law must run inside the penitentiary. The law could not stop at the prison gate. And also that justice was a personal human right of prisoners, like other citizens, and an essential precondition for their reformation. Now, this was the first legislative pronouncement in which politicians sought to introduce a culture of legality and a culture of human rights into the darkest recesses of the criminal justice system. That's a very difficult process to do. It was taken further by the Supreme Court of Canada in the Martineau case in 1979, where the court, Chief Justice Dixon, said the rule of law must run inside penitentiary walls. Now, it took the work of many lawyers, parliamentarians, politicians, dedicated civil servants. In the years after the Charter was the great pronunciation and declaration that, in fact, everyone was entitled to certain basic fundamental rights and freedoms. The Charter is quite clear. The Charter does not stop at the prison gates. Charter rights are fundamental rights. They are inherent rights. They're based upon the dignity of the individual. And where is that most challenged, more so than anywhere else in a Canadian penitentiary? And work proceeded to reshape the legal landscape of the Canadian federal penitentiary system in the image and in the spirit of the Charter. And the federal legislation, part of which has been amended by Bill C-10, set out to reflect in legislative terms the rights and responsibilities of offenders when they were sent to prison, consistent with public safety, consistent with reasonable limits, which are demonstrably can be demonstrated in a free and democratic society. It's a remarkable document, and it's the template for promoting and respecting human rights in prison. Now, translating legal architecture and legal rhetoric into practice is a very, very difficult thing in any area, particularly in a maximum security environment of a federal penitentiary, or any environment of a federal penitentiary. And just how difficult that has been over the years is best reflected in the report of Madam Justice Louise Arbour when she reported in 1994 on what happened to a group of women in the former federal prison for women, where they were strip-searched, segregated, and treated in a way completely contrary to what the law demanded and what fundamental human rights expected. In that report, she pointed to the fact that there was lacking a culture of respect for human rights in the Canadian federal penitentiary system. There were rules everywhere, but the rule of law was absent. Many other reports, particularly those reports of Howard Sapers, the correctional investigator, has documented the difficulty of translating human rights into operational reality in a prison to mitigate the brutalizing effects of confinement. Now, what we needed at this particular point in our history where internationally we profess to respect human rights, and where we travel to Afghanistan and other places to teach them how to run prisons with respect to human rights principles, what we needed was a reinvigoration of our own commitment to human rights. What we found in 2007 when the government appointed a so-called expert panel to advise it, the panel came up with a roadmap to public safety. And it is that roadmap which the federal government has translated into what it calls a transformation. You may not know this, but the federal prison system is going through a transformation. This was a 200-page report. There is not a single sentence, there's not a single footnote in that 200-page document to the concept of human rights. There is not a single reference to any decision of the Supreme Court of Canada on the Charter. It's as if the law does not exist. It's as if transformation of the federal prison system can take place in an amnesic context in which the law is irrelevant. And to the extent the law was irrelevant, the roadmap recommended, well, we should change it where it's inconvenient. There was a principle in the Corrections and Conditional Release Act that correctional authorities have to use the least restrictive measure. It's a principle of chartered jurisprudence. It's a principle which flows from the Declaration of International and Civil Rights. It's a fundamental principle of human rights law. Why would you want to use anything more than the least restrictive measure? Do you want to tell the correctional authorities, use the most restrictive measure? It's a principle of restraint on power. The roadmap recommended that it be rescinded, in fact, all reference be eviscerated in the Act, and in fact, correctional authorities should use the appropriate measures. In other words, to substitute for the law a principle of administrative convenience. And as a learned judge of the English Court of Appeal said many years ago, justice and convenience are often not on speaking terms. This government would have them to be on speaking terms with justice given a subordinate role. Now, Bill C-10, in fact, reflects a position in which human rights of prisoners actually should be recharacterized as privileges to be earned. That's quite inconsistent with how the Supreme Court of Canada has viewed human rights. They're inherent. They reflect human dignity. You don't have to earn the right to be treated decently. The government would turn that on its head. Prisoners in the future should have to earn rights. The federal prison system is being recast so that rights are, in fact, diminished to privileges, that, in fact, the federal prison population will have to demonstrate its worthiness. Now, I last week took a group of my students into a federal medium security penitentiary, and we met with a group of prisoners, many of whom have done over 20 years in prison. And my students asked them, what is happening given the government's agenda to make the conditions of prisons tougher, to send more people to prison for longer periods of time? And their common response was anyone around 30 years ago? Don't you realize what happened 30 years ago, the last time governments sought to restrict the lives of prisoners beyond the point of decency? There were riots, there were violence. And these prisoners, not as a threat, talked about what lay in the future with prisons closing in themselves. I'll give an example. Prisons often have big yards in which prisoners can exercise. The yards have now been crisscrossed and circumscribed with razor wire to stop people throwing drugs over the fence. Legitimate reason. A prisoner goes out of his cell into this external space, and all of a sudden, it's been cut in half. It's been cut further. psychologically, the prisons are closing in on themselves. Now, Howard talked about the fact that you now have in the prisons many more people who suffer from mental illness. You have many more Aboriginal offenders who suffer not just from the pains of imprisonment, but the further pains of the injustice of overrepresentation. You have prisoners who are now coming from young gang cultures where violence is extolled. What do you think is going to happen when you have more prisoners overcrowding prisons, suffering what they themselves experience as the practice of injustice, where living amongst them are people who are mentally ill, people who suffer from the oppression of a colonial regime? What's the likely outcome of that? And that's where I say we are going back to the future. There will, in fact, as Howard Sapers has pointed out, prisons become more volatile, more violent, more dangerous, not just to the prisoners, but to the public. And for prisoners at the end of their sentence to come out with that heightened experience of injustice, how does that ensure our safe streets and communities? It's the very opposite. I'll stop perhaps just with one point. In response to a question to Joanne's wonderful talk at lunch, someone asked the question, you know, radicalism somehow has become a dirty word again. I was viewed as a radical in the 1970s. I came from having worked in the American Civil Rights Movement when I was at Yale Law School, and my fellow colleagues at the Faculty of Law thought I was a lunatic. I offered to teach a course on Aboriginal rights and prisoners' rights. Well, everyone knew they didn't have any rights, so what the hell is he going to teach? When I did the research for one of my books 10 years ago, and I met with some young officers, they said to me, you know, I was talking to some of our head guards here, and they said, you've changed a lot. I said, how so? They said, well, you used to be a real radical. And now they say you're pretty moderate. You're kind of, you know, pretty reasonable. These were officers who told me also that when I went into the BC Penitentiary, the guards in the towers would have their guns on me and just talk to themselves and dare me to step off the grass. They were joking, but it's sort of a kind of a hard-edged kind of joke. And I was, when I heard that I was no longer regarded as a radical, I was kind of, I thought I was. I mean, what happened? I hadn't sold out. I still thought I had the power of my convictions. What I realized was that a lot of what I was advocating in those days had now become accepted as the appropriate way to run a prison. Respect for human rights was the official government line. Now, what we now have is a government which openly disavows the need to respect human rights in prisons. It's contemptuous of the Supreme Court of Canada's rulings on fundamental human rights. If the government is openly contemptuous, how would you expect a guard to respond on the line? If those in power are contemptuous of human rights, why would you be respectful in your everyday dealings with offenders? And so we are facing a point in which respect for human rights, in fact, will become eroded and will become endangered because of a government position that they are not important in the structure and administration of the criminal justice system. I am now seen, because I espouse the idea of human rights for prisoners, and because I oppose certain projects on behalf of my Aboriginal clients, I am now not just a radical, I'm now a public enemy. I'm a public enemy of public safety. I'm a public enemy of the public interests. It's remarkable from radical to public enemy in 40 years. I'm not concerned about my own reputation, but I am concerned about the reputation of Canada as an espouser of human rights in the darkest places. and the fact that that international reputation cannot be supported, and in fact should not be supported by the Canadian population. It doesn't reflect the mirror we want to hold up of the kind of society in which we want to live. Thank you.
We now have a good amount of time for questions, so I'd encourage anyone who has any questions to go ahead and go to the mics. Again, the same usual rules for questions will apply. Make sure that you ask a question and identify yourself so we know who you are. I invite you all to begin to ask questions.
My question is for Howard, and thank you very much to the conference organizers for bringing together such a wonderful panel. I'm a huge fan of Michael Jackson's and Howard's work as well, and Kim Pate in the back of the room, whose chair I accidentally stole. Anyway, the question is, a lot of federal watchdogs appear to be under a lot of pressure right now. Your work has maintained, I believe, its integrity and has been incredibly useful for organizations who push for human rights for prisoners, for due process. My question is, are you feeling the Stats Canada effect? You appear to have no concern for your reappointment. When is your term up? But are you feeling that kind of pressure around your reports? If you have, I'd just like to say congratulations in any event for being uncompromising in your analysis.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate the sentiment. My wife asks me similar questions. I'll give you a very straight answer. I have never been interfered with. I've worked for four different ministers. I was just reappointed on February the 8th for another term. When I went to Treasury Board a couple of years ago with an analysis of what I saw as a legislative agenda coming, saying I needed more resources, I got them. So I have no complaint. I've never had a phone call saying I shouldn't have said that. That might change after CPAC broadcasts this. I don't know. So I've got a job to do, and I'm trying to do it. And so far, I'm being given the freedom to exercise my mandate.
We have a question over here.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Greenberg, and I've actually, in full disclosure, I've worked with men as they in a reintegration program with prisoners. And I was just wondering, Mr. Saper, and really anybody, with this whole talk about prisoners going inside and lengthening sentencing and such, if there's any voices advocating for those who are coming out with this cutting, in the past 10 years, the decrease of education programs, vocational programs, and the minimal amount of money they give to men in halfway houses at about $42 a week here in Quebec, if there's any voices, and how the government continues to justify saying that they want to rehabilitate and retransition prisoners back into society without offering them services.
Yeah. It's a very good question, and you won't find much in Bill C-10 to warm your heart. But you're absolutely right in terms of ensuring safe streets and societies and communities, providing the resources for people to come out and make something of their lives is absolutely fundamental. And it's something which is not part of the agenda. It's quite interesting looking at Bill C-10. There's no amount of good recommendations that have come forward over the last 20 years from Howard Saper's office, from some of the work I've done, some of the work that Elizabeth Fry Societies have done, to change and improve and reform the system to make Canada a safer place. None of those recommendations, which are seen in any way as beneficial to offenders, form part of Bill C-10. Bill C-10 is an endeavor to heighten and increase and capitalize on a punitive obsession. It's meant, in fact, to to characterize and recharacterize Canadian criminal justice policy as tough on crime. And it's branding the criminal justice system, but at the same time, in terms of supplying and providing resources for men and women to come out and work in their communities as productive people, there's nothing in the legislation.
I'll just add very quickly that, you know, most federally sentenced offenders are returning to community now statutorily, so they're getting out statutory release as opposed to on a conditional release, which means that they were considered to be a high risk for release, and is counterintuitive because when they're out on SR, they're supervised for the shortest period of time in the community. So you've got something not quite working right, and perhaps one of the things that isn't working right is the Correctional Service of Canada, in spite of the budget that I talked about and the growth of its budget, will this year spend slightly more, just slightly more, than 2% of its budget on core correctional programs for offenders. So what that means is that inside a maximum security institution, there's hardly any programs. Inside medium security institutions where they're supposed to be program intensive to prepare people for release, it's not uncommon to see less than 10% of the population engaged in the correctional program on any given day. And if the prison population had a count that day of 350, there would probably be 200 on a waiting list to get into the programs that those 25 or 35 people were actually in. So it's not that what happens upon release isn't important. It's just that we've got to start addressing the concerns that you raise during the sentence itself.
Thank you. Alex?
Hi. I'm Alex Hundred. I was a panelist yesterday, this question. And I've also served some time in and out of detention centers post-G20, and I'm about to be going back in for a lengthy reformatory sentence. But I have a question based on something Professor Jackson said about how C10 is going to shift in the federal system to a position where human rights for prisoners are going to be considered, I can't remember what word you used, but essentially a privilege, and that's something that C10 is going to change. But my experience of the detention system was when I refused one of my set of bail conditions, which I would have thought I had a right to do, I was immediately thrown into the hole when I got back to jail, also known as administrative segregation, but put on what is called, in administrative segregation, total loss of privileges, meaning all I had was my boxers and my jumpsuit, no blanket, no pillow, no shoes even, and nothing else, and told that I was indefinitely on total loss of privileges. And so the question being, is it not already framed that way? And I guess this is also a question for Mr. Sullivan. And I don't know, hopefully I'll avoid the pen. It seems unlikely long term, but this is a question, I guess, about detention. And to what extent is that officially the way it works, or does it perhaps already actually work that way in the federal system? Or
that's a very good question. It goes back to my point that translating legal rhetoric and the legal architecture into the reality has always been riding against the current, and a very strong current. And that's more so in provincial institutions than in federal institutions. No provincial correctional system has been made over in the image of the charter. And so provincial systems across the country operate on a basis that, in fact, administrative discretion often trumps the law. And that's nowhere more so than in segregation. I've written about segregation, administrative segregation, indefinite segregation without charges, as being a litmus test of legitimacy. And as Howard in his annual reports has written, it is the most abused form of imprisonment. And so what you experienced in the provincial detention systems was a mirror image of, in fact, the difficulty of entrenching a culture of respect for rights is in any prison system. And That's why I made the point when the minister literally says we are not concerned about the protection of human rights as against the protection of the right to public safety, human rights become endangered. Endangered in the place where they are most in danger.
Does anyone else try to?
I don't really have much to add from, obviously I don't know a whole lot about detention from the victim's perspective. But one thing I would say though is, and this is not an issue that the victim's movement has spoken much about, the treatment or removal of human rights of offenders, but the one thing about, or those in prison, the one thing about, I talk about victims aren't a homogeneous group, the one thing that from my experience is that they all agree on is that they don't want what happened to them to happen to anybody else. And one of the things that we try to talk about, and not all of us agree, is that how we treat those who are in institutions will affect how they are when they come out, which can mean you can be re-victimized or someone else can be re-victimized, right? We talk a lot about child sex offenders, and the bill C-10 talks about, you know, the mandatory minimum penalties for sex offenders. I'm part of a steering committee for a group called Circles of Support and Accountability, which works with the highest risk sex offenders who are coming into prison. Volunteers will form circles around them, help them find jobs, help them do all these things. And my involvement isn't because I am like Michael or Howard, work with offenders. My involvement is as an advocate for victims because we want to make sure that people don't reoffend. And so, and I'm not suggesting you're in, you know, it's a different category, but the general idea about how we treat offenders is going to impact how they treat us when they come out. And so humane treatment for prisoners, if you don't care about them at all, it isn't about them. And this is, I think, a message we would like to deliver to Canadians who really don't care about treatment of people in prison. It isn't about them. It is about you, and it is about how safe we are when they come out. But, you know, that's a tough message to sell to, obviously, to this government, but it's also a tough message to sell within the victims' movement ourselves.
Thank you. Melissa.
Hi. I'm wondering if the federal government is developing any structural reformulations in response to criticisms that the Canadian prison system is becoming a warehouse for the mentally ill, and what you personally think such structural changes ought to look like.
Well, there's a number of things. I'll just address a couple of them quickly if I can. The very first thing is, and this is actually good news, a number of years ago, and actually with leadership from the federal government, there was a federal-provincial territorial structure established at both the ministerial level and at the official level to begin to work on a national strategy for mental health and corrections. This country doesn't have one. As you know, the Mental Health Commission in Canada was appointed a few years ago, and part of its mandate was to create a national mental health strategy, and a key component of that will be the intersection of justice and mental health concerns. So this is actually good news. The bad news is that it doesn't address what's happening today, where, as I say, we now know that at admission, up to a third of offenders will be referred for some kind of follow-up. We currently have in the federal system about 670 beds for acutely mentally ill offenders. It's about 50% of the identified need on any given day. And even if people are well when they enter into penitentiary, being in prison can also affect mental health. And so people become ill while they're incarcerated. And the system is under duress in terms of meeting those mental health needs because they can't recruit and retain mental health professionals that want to work in that system and under those conditions. So we've also made recommendations around expanding the exchange of service agreements and the federal, provincial, territorial, intergovernmental agreements. This is very important because the law requires the Correctional Service of Canada to be the health care provider. If you're a federally sentenced inmate, the province in which you happen to be incarcerated is no longer responsible for your health care. It's a total responsibility of the federal government through the Correctional Service of Canada. We've identified that, of course, prisons should never be hospitals. They can't be. But some inmates are patients. And when those patients' needs aren't being addressed in a carceral setting, they need to be put into a therapeutic health care setting. And so we're working on recommendations that will expand the range of options for patients to receive care in appropriate settings. In fact, some of this work came out as a result of the aftermath of the inquiries into Ashley Smith's death in Grand Valley Institution in Kitchener in 2007. So none of these lessons are newly learned, but they are finally beginning to get a little bit of traction.
Something I want you to say, arising from Howard's comments, and I want people to think about this carefully. When I take it you're all familiar, or most of you are familiar with what happened to Ashley Smith, that's a 19-year-old who died in federal custody in segregation after enduring months of segregation, where the staff were instructed not to intervene when she sought to strangle herself because she was trying to get attention, so as not to negatively, positively reinforce her bad behavior. The staff were told not to interfere, and they didn't, and she died. For me, that was the most shocking example I've ever come across of cruelty in prison. It's not the cruelty I knew in the 70s of guards beating guys senseless with batons. I can understand that. I can decry it and deplore it, but I can understand that kind of anger. But what I couldn't understand is a regime which would allow someone to die at the age of 19, who's clearly got mental illness problems, and do so on the basis that they were doing the right thing. For me, it was a shocking indictment of a system that lacks compassion, that has lost its way in respecting the dignity of a 19-year-old woman who's obviously got serious problems in dealing with life, let alone dealing with segregation. As she was dying, the government had this panel crafting this roadmap to public safety, this transformation, which did not even mention what had happened. What they did recommend is that the conditions in segregation actually were a little bit too easy, that perhaps they should be toughened up. So that you have, this is an example of what happens when you fail to give human rights a priority and a profile. You actually lose your way as a civilized society. You actually can tolerate and countenance watching a young woman die in front of you without anger, without compassion, simply a casualty of imprisonment. And there will be more casualties. You know, hopefully not as terrible as that one, but there will be more casualties. It's an inevitable and ineluctable consequence when human rights are simply taken off the priority list of a system of imprisonment.
Thank you. My question is directed to Howard. Since you gave a statistical report of what's happening in the prison system, this panel and previous panels, we had many suggestions and good suggestions. But my question is, how do you act? I mean, eventually, your audience here is 200 people, and but to be able to change the system, you have to reach the decision maker. And during elections, we don't hear these problems from the people who put themselves to the electorate system. So my question is, ideas are important, suggestions are important, comments are important, but an action should follow. So how do you put all these ideas into action so people who are in the decision making will change the system? That's the essence.
Well, I tried running for office. You know, the I, with it very respectfully, I want to push that back to you and the members of the audience. My office has been in existence since 1973, issuing annual reports. I won't ask, but before you came to today's session, how many people heard of the Office of the Correctional Investigator? The decision makers, let's not be confused when political decisions are made. These are not decisions that are made in a vacuum, and they're not based on ignorance. There's been lots of debate and discussion about Bill C-10, for example. Michael, Steve, dozens and dozens of other witnesses traveled to Ottawa and appeared before both Commons and Senate committees on C-10. Some people spoke in favor of the legislation, many others spoke in opposition to the legislation. The Library of Parliament wrote an excellent legislative summary on Bill C-10, which is available to any Canadian on the website with a click. Decision makers will be responsive to people who they want to vote for them. So I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think that it's going to be changed because I write another report or Michael writes another book, but it will be changed if people take the time to become informed and communicate their concerns to those people who are making decisions. I honestly don't know how else to answer your question.
Are you communicating your reports to the public in general?
My reports go to every member of parliament, every senator. They go on the website. They go to libraries. We distribute electronically and otherwise thousands of copies of our reports a year. So yes, it's available to anybody that wants it. And in fact, all of my reports, one of the things that I've done, particularly in the last 8 years, is we've started to issue public interest reports, so I don't just rely on my annual report. So we try to engage the public as much as we can in the work that we do.
I've got a response. I just want to preface it by, I was only here today, I wasn't here yesterday, but I've got to make the comment that the questions from the floor today, I think, are the best set of questions I've ever heard from the floor in any conference I've been at. And that's, your question is certainly worthy of that comment. It's a really, really important question, which a lot of us are exploring. Maybe it's come out a little bit in my presentation, but I've been doing this work for 40 years, and I was a believer. Joanne referred to Martin Luther King this morning. This is a quote which President Obama has used on occasion, that the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. I've worked for 40 years believing that's to be true. And my faith in that is tested very sorely today in the aftermath of Bill C-10. And not just the passage of the bill, but the fact that the government is so indifferent to principle, so indifferent to evidence, so indifferent to everything which I, as a lawyer, as a professor, as someone who's trying to make a contribution, puts value on. And so the issue becomes, how do you change that? And I asked the question this morning to the journalists, given that we are going to be relying so much on prison in the future, how come you don't write any stories about it? How come it's not part of the public knowledge to see whether or not the huge amounts of money, it is the most expensive part of the system, is it in fact benefiting? And of course it's difficult to do that work, but also they honestly said, try sell that story to an editor. And I've challenged prisoners to respond to that question. When I take my students into the penitentiaries, I say to the prisoners, I've got 20 students here who are interested in social justice. Why should they be interested in your issues? There are women who are losing their kids. There are mentally ill people. There are people living below the poverty line, have all kinds of legal issues that need socially committed lawyers that aren't looking at making a fortune from the law. Why should they care about you who've broken the law when there are lots of people who haven't broken the law who are struggling? And their answers are quite interesting. One of the answers is parallels Steve Sullivan says, that how we treat people in prison affects them when they come out of prison. And if we treat them with injustice, with the disdain for their human rights, why would they, as people who already have enough difficulty having respect for other people before they went in, have any more respect when they come out? So, but that's not an energizing prospect. Respect my rights or I'll kill you. You know, it doesn't get votes, it doesn't get stories. So we have to go, even though that's the reality. It's amazing how they then come up with the argument that respect for their dignity is something which they strive for. They try and create dignity for themselves in the prison, often in strange ways. And respect for dignity is the overarching fundamental principle underlying the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And how to operationalize that is the big question. And we, a number of us, are participating in an organization called the Smart Justice Network. We've tried to persuade opposition parties to get off this soft on crime, you know, tough on crime. It's a losing, the dichotomy between human rights of prisoners and human rights of victims is a false dichotomy, as Steve has explained. You know, we're not in opposition. Giving and respecting the rights of offenders is not at the cost of respecting the rights of victims of crime. They're not zero-sum games. And the Smart Justice Network is endeavoring to engage people in a discussion on how to use scarce resources in the most effective, constructive way to achieve justice and to achieve public safety, which again are not polar opposites. The government would have us believe, in the way it characterizes my efforts, that I'm an opponent for public safety because I argue about justice. I mean, they're not antagonistic concepts. You can't achieve public safety except through a just process. So I would, you know, if anyone, if you're interested, if you go to, I'm not sure what the Smart Justice links are, but if you go to Smart Justice Canada, I'm sure you'll find us. And it's a network of people who have something to say to try and influence citizens, politicians, to turn us back into a direction where the arc will, it's always a real tough push to get that arc of history bending towards justice, but no more so than any other time in certainly my history in Canada in the last 40 years.
Thank you. Steve, did you want to say anything about that?
I'll be brief. There has been, I don't know if there's ever been as much opposition to a piece of government legislation as there has been Bill C-10. And from groups that, like Smart Justice Network, there's a lot of us who, probably the first time we've sat down and had discussions, right? So as much as we talk about Stephen Harper's divisive politics, he's brought a lot of people together in a very odd way. But the truth is we're up against, I think talked a bit about last night with the films, right? The average person, these are complex arguments. What Michael talks about and the statistics that Howard provides, these are complex arguments. It's a lot easier to say, this guy raped a kid, so let's put him in jail for a long time, right? That's a hard argument to battle. But that's the substance of what it is that the government says. And for the average person, they like to hear that, right? We all feel better. None of us are going to lose sleep tonight if there's a sex offender in prison who's not getting his human rights respected. We might lose sleep when that guy comes out of prison and is a high risk to reoffend. But then we're going to say, well, the system wasn't tough enough because he shouldn't be out of prison.
So we have, the problem is we have the facts on our side, but we don't have the slogans and the taglines that the government does. And those are tough things to battle. And from victims of crimes perspective, the most vulnerable people that we work with, the sexual assault survivors, the women who are fleeing abusive relationships, the children who are on the street selling themselves for a warm meal, these are not the ones you're going to see at Justice Committee. They're not the ones you're going to see standing behind the Minister of Justice at the press conferences, right? They don't have a voice because they're too busy trying to survive to speak out. And so it's a select number, and I've been a part of those press conferences in the past with various governments. There's a select number of victims who were chosen to speak on behalf of all victims. And the ones who really need to have their voices heard, they don't have a voice because they're just busy surviving. She's deciding whether or not she wants to leave with her kids and face living in poverty, or just suck it up and keep getting beaten up, and at least her kids will have a roof over their heads, or they won't be taken away by CIS, right? She doesn't care what's going on. She just wants to survive. And there's no voice for her. So the government talks about victims. It all sounds great, but the majority of victims of crime who they talk about, they actually aren't talking about the most. They talk about the most high-profile cases, the homicide cases, all those. And who's going to feel bad for those offenders?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I wasn't standing up to speak about this, but since the discussion, there's a couple of comments I'd like to make, and certainly the other piece that Steve's just raised is that the evisceration of funding for quality-seeking groups, so particularly the women's groups who represented those victims, are no longer even in existence in large part, so that's certainly part of the issue. And also, I think the tide is turning. I think of it that we're going to have a wave. When I have my 13-year-old talking about her grade 7 class discussing these issues, I'm not so sure they were discussing them 2 and 3 years ago, what was currently happening in terms of law reform. But that's not what I stood up to comment and ask about. When the young woman, and I forgot her name, it was mentioned, when she stood up to ask about mental health and Howard, your response, I want to push a bit further on that because that response sounded nuanced. And I think it's time, not just on that issue, but on many issues, that we have to be much clearer, much stronger, and not try to be strategic. And that sounded like a strategic response. And I know Howard and I know each other well, so I know you mean this, and I know that I mean this in the friendliest ways. But to have more negotiated agreements in a context where one of the biggest problems, as I think Michael raised, is that not that we can't, part of it is we can't sometimes get the information out of the prisons, but the other part is even when we do, it's not believed. When I take in law students to prisons and they say, "We actually thought you were exaggerating these stories." When I took Ashley's story out and people didn't believe it, when the whole description of her before she died was of someone not with mental health issues, not at all, but a bad, problematic, misbehaving, assaultive, nasty prisoner, that's a vastly different way than the way she's described now. Yet that was the depiction. So to get her assistance was incredibly difficult. And what I think it underscores is the need to be very clear that the provisions of the law right now allow, if you have a health issue, you can and must be taken out of the prison for some things. We don't expect prisons to perform cardiac surgery. The notion that we have any kind of nuanced response to mental health, I think, is equally egregious. I think we have to argue that they have to be taken into community-based resources and have those mental health services developed even where they don't exist now. And that should be the focus of our legal arguments and the focus of our advocacy, because otherwise they get into prisons, and as we have the situation the last time I was in the Regional Psychiatric Center, which is duly designated a psychiatric center and a penitentiary, where the head of psychiatry, who is supposed to have authority, says, this woman needs an advocate. We can't get her out of the situation she's in, and she's been restrained on a bed for 6 weeks. That, you know, those are the realities of trying to have a nuanced response to mental health. And I understand your position, but I think for this audience, the question has to be, how can we continue to pretend that we can bring nuanced responses in an environment where that will only be bastardized and will be moved in a way that will be counter to the interests and the human rights of the very individuals we're trying to support. And that's not your intention. I know that. You know that. We all know that. But that certainly is one of the potential ramifications. So why not take a very strong position and say, under no circumstances can those with mental health issues be in a prison environment? They must be. And we must be using all of our limited resources that are left to argue for that, whether it's as lawyers, whether it's as those doing advocacy in other contexts, whether it's as the Ombuds Office, whether it's as the victim's advocate, whether it's in whatever context, and publicly.
Sure. For those of you who don't know, this is Kim Pate, the executive director of the Canadian Association of Blues and Fry Societies, and Kim is probably the most tireless advocate for social justice that I know in this country. So, and I've had the privilege of knowing and working with Kim in different capacities for a long time. So when Kim kicks me, I feel it deeply. So usually what I say to Kim is, because it's true, you're right. And she's right on the points that she raised. And yes, it is strategic. It's a big system, and in some ways a resistance system. But we have also made some very, very specific recommendations that are being acted on, or that we're trying to figure out a way to make sure that they're acted on. So very specific recommendations to ensure, for example, that segregation ceases today for somebody who has a diagnosed Axis 1 disorder, that you just don't put them in a seg cell, that a comprehensive treatment plan follow every person who gets admitted to one of the five regional psychiatric centers before they, or is prepared before they're released back to a parent institution. That particularly for women, that immediately agreements be sought for placements to local therapeutic health-centered environments, so that women are not shipped from all over the country to the Churchill unit at the regional psychiatric center in Saskatoon. So there's a number of very specific, very concrete things that are in play, including there's been identified a range of options that will see offenders having their mental health care needs met in the community, and in fact even some movement to get people out on conditional release for the purpose of being placed into specialized resources dealing with mental health issues. So, Kim, you're right. The time for the debate is over. The need is well documented, well recognized, and some good solutions have been identified as well. So let's get on with it. And I continue to be optimistic. Is it enough to just rely on a national strategy and then say the work's done? Of course it isn't.
So I know that you'll likely put it in your report anyway, but the fact that most prisoners who have Access 1 diagnoses are re-diagnosed to be taken out of that category, so I'm sure you'll be addressing that as part of that recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kim. I think that that last question was a very important one, and although we're coming up on our time, I just wondered if Michael or Steve might want to say something about the difficulty of responding to ideological rhetoric with nuanced policy proposals.
Perhaps I can just address that, particularly in terms of Kim Pate's role and the brother organization, the John Howard Society of Canada, and their executive director, Catherine Latimer, both of whom appeared before the House of Commons and Senate committees. Catherine was a former lawyer for the Department of Justice, so she hardly comes with my kind of background. And yet both she and Kim, representing the two most senior nonprofit organizations advocating for human rights and reintegration of offenders, were characterized by the government as advocates for criminals. You know, John Howard and Elizabeth Fry, particularly John Howard, if you know anything about John Howard, was someone who in the late 18th, early 19th century advocated for the modern penitentiary system as a place of punishment and rehabilitation. Those were the twin pillars. He advocated for a safer society, for a more humane society, by invoking imprisonment that met minimum standards. We didn't have international human rights standards, but he had his own sense of decency. And the idea that the contemporary holders and bearers of that message would be characterized as advocates for criminals is the worst kind of example of false advertising, of branding and dealing with the message by demonizing the messenger. And for governments to resort to that as the way in which they get passage of legislation, you know, is a loud message of how far down the road we've gone to politicizing criminal justice as if it was an advertising campaign in which buy our brand and you'll have a better life. Don't worry about the fine print. Don't worry about the nuances. Don't worry about costs and benefits. Just trust us. We know we're doing the right thing.
I think we've come up on our time, but thank you so much. I'd like to extend a warm applause to our panelists today, Michael Jackson, Howard Sapers, and Steve Sullivan. And thank you all for your excellent questions. We'll see you in 15 minutes. Exactly.
Great. I don't have to say it.